I think the ETF is extremely bullish to the Bitcoin price because of the amount of money that would be flowing in. Look, I'm not a macro guy, I'm a geopolitics guy, but I could tell you that, BlackRock alone has, I think last time I checked, $8.9 trillion assets under management. Fidelity, it has trillions of dollars as well. Franklin, like all these massive asset managers have trillions and trillions of dollars. If just a small percentage of that went into Bitcoin, I think, it would be a game changer. But there's another component as well, which is that Michael Saylor and Nayib Bukele on the nation state level are being vindicated right now. When the next cycle peak happens, if you're a public company, if you're a country, and you're looking at what Nayib Bukele is doing, and you're looking at what Michael Saylor is doing, you're saying, wow, his strategy was superior. He holding Bitcoin on my balance sheet is actually a much better idea than holding fiat. Michael Saylor says it best. He's like, holding fiat is like holding a melting ice cube. And I think that because these are public companies and they have to adhere to their shareholders, I think that there's going to be mounting pressure for these public companies to put at least a small percentage of their treasury in Bitcoin. Like Apple and all these companies, they're holding so much cash.
Nico, how are you doing, man? Long time no see.
Yeah, it's been a really long time. I'm doing great, man. Super happy to be on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for coming back on my show. I've been from time to time, I've been listening. I mean, I haven't had much time, but listening to your regular talks or chats with Ben Perrin, BTC Sessions. So it's pretty cool. You guys are like, recapitulating everything that's been going on. It's pretty cool summaries you guys are giving. Yeah. So yeah. So I thought, Nico. So first of all, for people who might not know who you are, I mean, you're pretty well known in the space. You're the host of the Simply Bitcoin TV show and podcast. And you're also, what kind of position do you have at Swan?
So I'm the director of content strategy. Essentially, I run their YouTube, I run their Rumble, any type of video related content. I probably have my hands on it some way or the other. And just kind of figure out, what type of content do we post on the Swan channel to, number one, grow the channel, and number two, to really, get orange pill people to win the race to avoid the war, so to speak, like Corey wrote that piece. So yeah, that's my role at Swan. It's awesome. Really, really enjoy it. Have a great team that that I work with that make incredible content and whatnot. So yeah, that's my role.
Awesome. Yeah, and you guys have been it's been watching this a little bit, the educational series moderated by Natalie Brunel. Did you have a hand in that, or did you co-organize or whatever, co-create it a little bit, or did you have some input on that onto that?
So the Welcome to Bitcoin course, no, I really have to give credit to Nick and Brady and Brandon. They've really been pushing that forward. That, of course, and Natalie, she's incredibly talented. They've really been pushing that initiative forward. Of course, I did a lot of the packaging, so the title, the thumbnail, and all that stuff. But I'm glad that you liked it. It was
Yeah.
really, really well received. I'm really glad to have played a small part in the release of that, specifically on YouTube and on Rumble. But yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's very succinct, comprehensive at the same time, and very, covers all the topics, all the like the fallacies of thinking, and it's just great. So, Nico, yeah, What I wanted to get your get me a little bit up to date, like what is your view of the things going on around globally, like with of course rooted in Bitcoin, with the legislation you're pushing for CBDCs connecting to censorship and digital ID and the things that had been going on, in Canada, where I mean people were their bank accounts were frozen. And do you see do you think that we are, as a Bitcoin community or in Bitcoin space, evolving fast enough while all these things are going on?
Are we evolving fast enough to keep up with the monetary demons? I think so. I think that the question is, are we going to win the adoption race before they roll these things out? We know that they're unpopular. We know that people, if they're informed, are just, they're like, why do I need a CBDC? So it's really our job to wake enough people up to this reality. I'm very optimistic about the global South, Latin America, just because I see that they, out of incentive, right? Like if your fiat currency is broken, you seek an alternative out of necessity. And we've seen a lot of adoption in stable coins in the global South. People are just they're seeking refuge. A small percentage of that is Bitcoin. Our job as Bitcoiners to really wake people up to saying, hey, look, you're only going to find financial sovereignty in Bitcoin. But they're moving full steam ahead. Christine Lagarde, she's making videos. The European Central Bank, I think it was a couple of days ago, released a picture saying, we respect your privacy.
Oh, yeah.
Here in the United States, they are not only attacking the industry, from my point of view, I think they're attacking the right to self-custody, to be honest with you. They're trying in the DOJ conference that they had in regards to Binance last week. The amount of times that they mentioned terrorism and crypto in the same press conference, I was just like starstruck, because
But on the
essentially,
other hand, it's a deja vu. It's like we've seen this before, right? I mean,
yeah, but I don't think that we've seen this before to this escalation. Like,
really? Like a
and the
frontal,
amount.
like, do you see that as a frontal attack to like self-custody? I mean,
Inevitably, yes, I really believe that. I think that that's their ultimate end goal. Elizabeth Warren in a Senate Banking Committee, I think it was 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks ago, she said the quiet part out loud. She said that, people are using ever more sophisticated means to skirt around money laundering laws, like taking self-custody. So she's like trying to essentially, like on a psychological level, she's trying to connect self-custody with crime. And then that's why the DOJ press conference was so striking, because they were trying to connect terrorism with Bitcoin. And the issue isn't with Bitcoiners. Bitcoiners are just like, that's a lie. The issue is with the uninformed, right? If you are uninformed and you still consume legacy corporate media, you don't consume independent media, you don't do your own research, you're all of a sudden you're going to start connecting the dots. I'll give you an example. A couple of days ago, 2 or 3 days ago, I had the privilege to be invited to the to this event in South Carolina, where Jack Dorsey, Luke Dash Jr., Bitcoin Mechanic, revealed Ocean, which is quote unquote the first decentralized mining pool. And it was great to be able to witness it firsthand. But Jack Dorsey went out to tweet something about in relation to the pool. And I kid you not, I'm not joking. The day after, the BBC and a bunch of other legacy media outlets said that Bitcoin mining uses more water on a daily basis than entire Olympic-sized swimming pools.
unbelievable.
So they used the word pool in their propaganda attack. And Do you think that's a coincidence? The day after that announcement was made, that's not a coincidence.
No.
Right. So yeah, we are in the middle. We're in the midst of this information narrative trench warfare where governments are trying to convince the public. Bitcoiners are on the side of truth. So all we need to do is just expose the lies, misrepresentations, and hypocrisy. And hopefully we do that fast enough and quick enough where we wake up enough of the population where, let's say in the US, you have 5 to 10% of the population that are Bitcoiners or anywhere around the world. Good luck trying to pass anti-Bitcoin legislation. Like, it's not going to be possible for the politicians. So they're really in a race against time.
Yeah, that's why I put the semi-title of this show, like Speed of Hyper-Bitcoinization. I mean, it sounds a little bit like, you know, like a little bit superficial, but that's exactly the insight I wanted from you, like, or your perspective. Well, I'm really concerned, you know, what's going on, you know, in the European Union and in the States. I mean, it's like all, it's a global, you know, these are global initiatives, you know, and while you're talking, you know, about, you know, terrorism. It's like how many trillions of dollars, you know, are being or have been laundered through the fiat central banking, monetary, whatever banking system every year. You know, and people have no fucking notion, you know, like what real terrorism means, actually. You know, would it be child trafficking or drug trafficking, weapons? I mean, it goes through the fiat central banking system.
Senator Cynthia Lummis, the Bitcoin senator from Wyoming, she released a graphic during the Senate Banking Committee where she essentially said the quiet part out loud. She said that essentially 99% of illicit finance is conducted through the traditional financial system. No, it's more than 99%. It was like 99.67%. Like it's like an astronomically high number. And only a small fraction is used, done with crypto and quote unquote Bitcoin. But the amount of emphasis that they're putting on Bitcoin and crypto tells me that they're not really concerned about the money laundering. Like when a government is telling me, like when the US government is telling me, and they're is like, the United States is a country of laws. Oh, really? You follow them? Like, are you a politician? You have the cleanest, like everything that's been going on the last 2 or 3 years, right? Whatever political side you're on, it doesn't matter, right? The leading political opponent of the leading political opponent of Joe Biden, who's currently president, is being charged with crimes, right? So the US has gone down this path, right? And not to mention all the money that's being sent to Ukraine, not to mention the, you know, whether it's the war on terrorism, the Patriot Act, you know, you could say that there's current dealings, if you were to believe them or not, coming out of the current president that are somewhat, you know, questionable. And of course, for some reason, it's rules for thee and not for me. So the political class, the political elite, the uniparty, the administrative state in the United States is playing by a different set of rules than the rest of us have to play by. So when they have this press conference and they grandstand and they tell us the United States is it's a country of law and order, and you know, CZ, he broke the law, and crypto is connected to terrorism and he facilitated terrorism. Like, I'm sorry, I don't, like, if it was 20 years ago, I would have believed it. Maybe if it was 10 years ago, I would have believed it. But after what we've lived through as a country, as the world, with the pandemic and everything that happened over the last 2 or 3 years, forgive me if I don't, like, I'm like, who are you to tell me that? You aren't necessarily the most honest person I've ever seen. This is the same. And Janet Yellen was part of that press conference. She was saying that the US was going to have no inflation, even though we printed a record amount of money, Like, I'm sorry. Like, and I don't want to name all the other things because they're outside of the Overton window, but it's just like there's been so many things and so many events that have happened over the last couple of years that I'm just like, who, like, you guys are the biggest cartel mafia I've ever seen. Like, it's insane. Who are you to lecture me or lecture the world on what is right and what is wrong if you guys can't even follow those laws yourselves?
Yeah.
And you, and not only that, you aren't even held accountable for those same laws.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, the thing, the system is clearly breaking. I think fiat is responsible for all this. I think that the more they print and the acceleration of the printing is really going to have, downstream effects down the line, in my opinion.
Yeah. And, you know, whatever we can imagine, whatever we know, the reality is actually much worse than, you know, we can actually, I mean, we are, I mean, the two of us are a lot, you know, so many people, you know, within the Bitcoin community and then even beyond are, they have, they comprehend this, you know, the, everything that's been saying, you know, about like how fucking systemically corrupt and fraudulent and criminal and beyond criminal this whole system is. But it's a, to be honest with you, I mean, sometimes I have empathy with my fellow human beings because it's not easy to, first of all, to, you know, to be open-minded because it, your whole worldview would just shatter, you know, break down like a house of cards. And it's worse. It's like beyond imagination. It's worse than that. You know, that's what I was saying, you know, like the trillions and trillions that have been missing, you know, I mean, Catherine Austin Fitz had been, you know, preaching about this. I mean, she's an insider. She's a whistleblower, you know, and like how many, like 20, 21, that's just the official number, you know, it's been just siphoned off, you know, I mean, when was the last audit of the Pentagon, you know, or,
no, they failed. They failed. It was worse. They failed. Like they failed like six audits, dude. Like it's so absurd. Like it's absurd.
A fucking clown show, man. I mean, look at Pelosi. You know, I mean, how can people, you know, politicians like Pelosi, you know, who have like, what is it? Yearly salary of what? What is it? 200,000? I don't care. You know, but you know, get a total. You know, net volume of wealth in the area of whatever, $150-200 million. How do you get that? When and of course they're not going to advocate for laws that, you know, that clean up this whole you know, this whole fraud, you know, and insider trading. But that's just an example. I'm just saying, you know, it's
yeah, and there's so many examples of that. There's so many examples of this just like blatant in your face theft. Like, you know, because it's theft. Like that's what it is.
And the election was stolen. Come on, let's just articulate it. Come on, man. I mean, it's a fucking fraud, you know. It was stolen and the guy is not even a legitimate president, you know? I mean, the election was stolen. I mean, and probably and most probably and definitely it's not the first time, you know, because there are different ways to manipulate or to defraud the whole election system, right? But anyway, that's
Like I said, outside of the topic of the Overton window, but I'll say one comment about that. And what I'll say is, it was the first time in American history where this never happened before. They didn't finish the counting the same day, essentially, and they stopped the counting. You know, late into the night. I've never seen that before. And that will be my comment in regards to what you said.
That's good. That's good. Good enough. So Nico, what do you think about this whole, you know, I mean, people are like, I don't know, like I'm hoping they're not selling hopium. Maybe they're like really credible people in the space are like, yeah, once spot PTFs are formally, you know, allowed into the market, you know, probably simultaneously when it's going to be like whenever in January, the price is going to, you know, pump because of, I mean, I understand logically it would make sense because there's a lot of liquidity and, you know, demand, institutional demand, and, you know, the career risk is gone and from a lot, maybe even pension funds. I mean, do you see that a chain reaction going and really pushing the price? Let's just say really pessimistically to 100,000, 200,000, which is realistic. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, is it just too overhyped?
Yeah. So what's my take on the potential outcome of the ETF? Look, I was extremely disappointed by Bitcoin's price performance last halving. I think a lot of us were. I think a lot of us were expecting $100,000 Bitcoin. I think the reason that we didn't get to that point is because of rehypothecation from exchanges like FTX that were literally selling. They weren't selling real Bitcoin. They were literally selling paper Bitcoin, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the most important factor, which I don't hear a lot of people talk about, is the China ban. So essentially, if you take a look at the Bitcoin hash rate and the Bitcoin price, you will see a direct correlation between when the price fell the first time, the first time we reached the peak, we fell, the hash rate fell before that. And essentially the hash rate fell before that because that's when China made it illegal to mine Bitcoin mining within their borders. Now, still, it's estimated that between 15% of the hash rate is still located in China. So the incentives are still winning. And the hash rate today is 9 times higher than before the China ban happened, but that happened right in between the middle of the last bull market. And I believe that played a major role in taking the momentum out of the price action, because essentially all those miners needed to sell a lot of Bitcoin in order to relocate to more favorable jurisdictions overseas. That being said, the theory, the blind spot, this cycle is the theory of diminishing returns. Now, it kind of makes sense if if you're logical about it. The law of big numbers plays in. It's a lot harder for Bitcoin to get from 100,000 to 200,000 than it was for Bitcoin to get from $100 to $1,000, right? And just in numerical terms. So that's the theory now. So what I'm sensing in the community, whether it's YouTube and Twitter and whatever, is that the price predictions and the anticipation of where Bitcoin can go is a lot lower, right? A lot of people are like, I'd be happy with $100,000 if that, I'd be happy with $120,000. Now, I'd be honest with you, that would really bum me out if that was the case. But if we're to learn from the last cycles, Bitcoin tends to do the exact opposite of what people expect it to do. So you could see a lot of people selling at 100K because they're thinking, okay, we're reaching the top, and then this thing blow up to $500,000 in the next cycle. I think we don't know. I think the ETF is extremely bullish to the Bitcoin price because of the amount of money that would be flowing in.
How much money are we talking about? Like, how many hundreds of billions?
Look, I'm not a macro guy. I'm a geopolitics guy, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that, BlackRock alone has, I think last time I checked, $8.9 trillion assets under management. Mm-hmm. Fidelity, it has trillions of dollars as well. Franklin, like all these massive asset managers have trillions and trillions of dollars. If just a small percentage of that went into Bitcoin, I think, it would be a game changer. But there's another component as well, which is that Michael Saylor and Nayib Bukele on the nation state level are being vindicated right now. Michael Saylor's average price is about $30,292. That means that his investment, with all the shit he got for it, because he got a ton of shit, he has been vindicated. He was right. He was really, really right. He was beyond right. And now all of a sudden, when the next cycle peak happens, if you're a public company, if you're a country, and you're looking at what Nayib Bukele is doing, and you're looking at what Michael Saylor is doing, you're saying, wow, his strategy was superior. He holding Bitcoin on my balance sheet is actually a much better idea than holding fiat. Michael Saylor says it best. He's like, holding fiat is like holding a melting ice cube. And I think that because these are public companies and they have to adhere to their shareholders, I think that there's going to be mounting pressure for these public companies to put at least a small percentage of their treasury in Bitcoin. Like Apple and all these companies, they're holding so much cash.
Yeah, that's what really intrigues me. I mean,
and it's melting.
It's melting.
It's melting.
So what, is there some kind of other forces behind that? That's just, I mean, that it's just so illogical that they're not doing it. I mean, why is it? What's the incentive? What's the?
So like, what's the incentive?
Yeah, to hold so much cash. I mean,
I think that, you know, it's pretty straightforward. I think that essentially, you know, there is politically motivated I think that some of it could be politically motivated. Like the current administration, the Biden administration has made it very, very clear that they are just not fans of the industry. They really, if they had the ability, they would have rolled out a central bank digital currency by now. They just don't have the support in Congress. And I think that they're in a pickle right now. They're in a kind of like this catch 22. But I think as a whole, like if you kind of zoom out, I think that the world is reaching this like level of peak fiat, peak centralization. And essentially, because fiat has broken the world to such an extent, the main benefactors of fiat, right, which is this government, politicians, quintillionaires, they're incentivized to censor, to steal, to lie, to manipulate, to misrepresent information as much as humanly possible in order to keep their control on the truth and their narrative control on the truth, because that's the only way they can keep this going. Because as soon as people start to ask the question, what is money? Why is my money stealing from me? Why am I being forced to use a money that is designed to lose purchasing power? I already pay my taxes. I never agreed to this. I think that they don't have a really good response to that. And the reason I'm saying that is because they've completely ignored, like Elizabeth Warren or any of the papers that were written by the Treasury or the White House. They're essentially making the case that people are seeking, even Jerome Powell, I think, said this, like people are seeking Bitcoin because they want more and a more efficient means of payment. We have very efficient means of payment in the US. We have Cash App, we have Zelle, we have PayPal. People aren't seeking a more efficient means of payment. People are seeking to use money that doesn't steal from them.
Yeah.
And they've ignored that completely, which tells me that they just don't have a good answer to that response, yeah. Right?
Didn't Powell, even in a hearing or some kind of congressional whatever hearing, like whether intentional or not, I mean, say, you know, it is an alternative store of value to Bitcoin, for, you know, Bitcoin is sort of a store of value. Didn't he say something like that? Or am I confusing something, maybe another statement? Anyway, but I thought he said it, you know, that it's sort of a alternative sort of value, some kind of hearing. But okay, maybe I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so Powell, to be honest with you, he's not that, like, he hasn't been, like, he hasn't been that adversarial compared to, let's say, he hasn't been that adversarial compared to someone like Janet Yellen. But that's still not to say that he's a fan, because at the end of the day, I think that if you're the head of a central, if you're the head of a central bank, Bitcoin is the death of you, because it questions the very system of central banking. Sure. Why do you think that they attacked Nayib Bukele so much? Look at what they did to Javier Milei. They tried to throw anything and everything at that guy. He's a far right. He's a libertarian. he's not a fascist. He's not an ultra conservative, whatever. He's a libertarian, right? And they're calling him a far right extremist. You know, yeah, who they also call the far right extremist? Mm-hmm. Nayib Bukele. Nayib Bukele and Javier Milei in Argentina, they are threats to the very idea of central banking. And that is a big effing problem. And that is so dangerous, because once they prove, and I don't know about Javier, it's too early.
But to be honest, yeah, I'm not sure about Javier. I mean, I love his, you know, Austrian economics, libertarian, you know, rants. And I mean, it's beautiful. But the things that he's done, I mean, you can call it controversial. And then meeting with Bill Clinton,
that was weird, right?
It's really weird. And then, you know, really becoming weird. A Zionist. And I mean, I'm really, really straightforward with you. I mean, this is, I'm totally anti-nation, anti-religious, anti-whatever, but I'm pro, you know, human. So I don't know. Is it being blackmailed? Is it being threatened? I don't know. Or is it being put? Are there any oligarchs that there are actually some oligarchs that have been funding him? But that's, you should listen to Whitney Webb's one of the latest interviews. I can send it to you. She goes pretty deep into the background of Javier Milei. But you know, I still like his, you know, you know, as you said, you know, he's libertarian, Austrian economic, you know, like freedom and you know, fuck the socialists and all of that. But something doesn't make sense. I mean, with Bukele, I had a more, even, you know, emotionally, you know, viscerally, a more positive feeling. But yeah, that's the way it is. It's, yeah, let's see.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, look, like, if we're being honest and, you know, sincere, like, it's like the issue is essentially that, you know, this is a lot of American politics, the pendulum swings very hard. So like, it either swings to the left and then it swings back to the right as a reaction, and then it kind of swings back like and forth, and like that's been the history of Latin America for a very, very long time. That's why what Nayib Bukele did was so extraordinary. I think it's too early to tell with Javier. Let's see. Like, I know that one of the first things that he said is that he still has every intention to end the central bank. I could tell you that is definitely a step in the right direction. Not so much if he's going to allow that, but in politics, there's this concept of the Overton window, which is the acceptable window of discussion, right? And if you talk about ending the central bank in the United States, it would be outside of the Overton window, except for Bitcoiners and hardcore libertarians. But most people would be like, nah, that's extreme. But the fact that you had a president elected to a country, a G20 country. Argentina is a big country. It's like 45 million people. And he's saying, let's end the central bank. And he's taking a chainsaw and cutting it into pieces. And that was accepted by the majority of the population. That is a step in the right direction for our cause.
That means something.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So even if he doesn't live up, because it's very hard, he must have a lot of pressure. I don't know what his net worth is, but you know, politicians that tend to be poor when they get into office, they use the office to enrich themselves. Mm-hmm. Is he going to fall into that trap? Is he going to be noble? Is he going to be honorable? Is he going to have ethics and morals and all that stuff? I don't know. I have no idea. But political discourse is important, and he moved that right to a really, really good side for us Bitcoiners. And we need all the help we can get. Right. We have one beachfront, the country of El Salvador, the shining city, shining country on a hill. Now we need more countries falling like dominoes, adopting Bitcoin, making Bitcoin legal tender.
Yeah.
And the more countries do that, the better.
Mm-hmm. I had discussions like what's the critical number, the critical mass of countries, especially like in Africa or Latin America, that just needed, you know, to you know, unleash this power, you know, of hyper-Bitcoinization. Maybe it's just really three, four, five countries, and And then it, you know, the competitive pressure comes, you know, and then everybody's like, okay, we need to, there's something we need to change, you know. I mean, just coming maybe even from the grassroots level, you know, from the people themselves, like these people are making something right, right, in El Salvador, or hopefully, you know, in Argentina soon. And, right, so maybe it's going to become really a sudden process, as Parker Lewis would call it. But we'll see, right? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. I don't know when, you know, I don't know like what the critical mass is. I think that we're living through very turbulent times mm-hmm. in history. I think we're living through two phenomenons that are happening simultaneously, kind of overlapping each other. The internet started the fire, and it really disintermediated information. And start, and you see this with social media. So the ability for governments to control narratives is greatly diminished once individuals are able to talk freely directly with each other. That's why they're attacking Elon with Twitter. Look at what me and you are doing right now. We're talking, you know, in our homes with microphones, cameras, and we're broadcasting and people are listening to this. That didn't exist 20 years ago. You had to go through the TV stations. You had to go through the newspapers. They've been disintermediated. And the younger generations, they only get their information from these sources. And governments, it's very difficult for them to co-opt every single one of these sources. And it becomes very difficult for them. That's why they're reacting like, we're going to censor the internet and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And that's happening, right? So the disintermediation of information. And then overlapping that is the disintermediation of money, right? Which is like now all of a sudden, the governments are dealing with two problems. Like, holy, we can't no longer control the narrative. Now people have a choice between using our money and using their money. And they're just like, holy cow, what is happening? And it's causing chaos. Like they don't know what to do. In my opinion, they're scared because the information thing is one thing, but once people start opting out of their money, that is their direct source of power. That is how they pay the men with guns.
It goes to the roots. Yeah.
So yeah. That scares them. And I think that eventually they're going to have, and you've seen this, they're going to start saying the quiet part out loud, which is, we don't want you to take self-custody. We don't want you to use your own money. We want you to use our money. And I don't know how they're going to, I don't know how they plan to explain that. I don't know how they're going to convince people to go along with that, but it's a very, very big problem that they have. Because I think ultimately what Bitcoin does is, and if the world moves to a sound money standard, is that essentially it completely changes the power dynamics between individuals and the nation state. All of a sudden, governments, if people adopt Bitcoin, there's a Bitcoin standard, governments are no longer going to be able to pay for things they can no longer afford through with the hidden tax of inflation. If they want to pay for something, they're going to have to do it via direct taxation or wealth confiscation or direct wealth confiscation.
Yeah,
or and that becomes very, very difficult to do. You know, especially on a massive scale. And I think over the long term, that changes the relationship between the individual and the government and the state. And the sovereign individual laid this out. Like they predicted this in the 90s, right? And I think we're witnessing their theory. They didn't get everything right, but we're witnessing their theory play out in slow motion.
Yeah. So the system wants to restrict or control the flow of information, the fundamental basis of information, which is let's just call it the internet. I mean, but they can't do that. I mean, is the internet, I mean, decentralized enough, or it's not decentralized, but is it partitioned enough that you know that it is preventable, or are we, do we have, is that our obligation, or is that our mission to you know, with Nostr and other platforms to, you know, to seek out and develop other decentralized platforms, like totally, like, you know, detached from the system.
So I'm a big fan of Start9. And Start9 is, they started as a Bitcoin node, and they eventually, they became essentially their products. And I run, you know, a Start9 Server Pure Pro at my house, just a top of the line product. And essentially it's a server, right? So I run my Bitcoin node on it. It's a full computer, but it also allows me to download other apps that make it that, let's say you had that same app running at home on your computer or on your server, and Start9 makes it super easy for you to do this. We can have peer-to-peer communications, file sharing, potentially video conferencing, because essentially how the internet works now, even services like Signal that are big supporters of free speech and, you know, encrypted messages, and, you know, supposedly they don't want people to, you know, snoop into your conversations. Even still, when you, let's say me and you, let's just use Zoom, for example, or we're using now, me and you aren't communicating directly. I'm communicating to Zoom servers, and the Zoom servers are communicating to you, and then you are communicating to the Zoom servers, and the Zoom servers are communicating to me. So the internet right now isn't peer-to-peer. Most services on the internet that we use, it's Twitter, Zoom, YouTube, Rumble, anything, you name it, they're not peer-to-peer.
Right.
They're all being hosted on servers. I think the future is sovereign computing, where you're running your own server. You are hosting your own data, right? And in the process of doing that, instead of everyone going through this single choke point that governments can and have in the past, you know, used for their political means, imagine if everyone is just communicating directly peer-to-peer, which is essentially how Bitcoin works, really, especially if you run your own node. But imagine if data worked that way. Imagine if messaging worked that way. I think it would be better. Now, to go back to your original question, which is the internet decentralized? No, at the end of the day, internet is just a bunch of cables that go under the sea. Mm-hmm. You know, they go into buildings. And because of that, governments can, you know, they can, you know, cut the wire, which they have in the past during protests and all right. that stuff. They've pulled down services. But I think that the more and more people get informed, and that the more and more people realize, like, is the government really by the people for the people, or is the government for the government by the government? I think more and more people are going to have problems against that. And I think as the population ages, more and more of those people are going to be in positions of power, right? In positions of influence. I think as Bitcoin's market cap grows and Bitcoiners as a whole become wealthier, they will become more influential. They'll be able to affect certain, you know, certain politics, and they'll be able to affect and influence society in a certain way to free up that society. But I think that this is an arms race. It's a continued arms race all the time between the forces of centralization versus the forces of decentralization.
Yeah, this is exactly, you know, what you're saying is alludes to that first question I asked, you know, or one of the first questions, you know, like, are we fast enough? Is that because we are in a race, we're in an arms race. So are we going to make it, you know, because I see so much, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm very optimistic and realistic, but I'm just, you know, I'm trying to be, you know, realistic, like seeing all the pressures mounting up, you know, the criminal entities, the central banking system, the EU, you know, European Union. I mean, that's sometimes concerning. It's concerning. It's concerning. You know, is it, but you know, we're making progress. I mean, look at all the developments that, you know, you just mentioned Start9 Lab, whatever, and then Paolo Arduino, what's his platform? Keet, is that Keet or something like that? The peer-to-peer platform. So there are things going on, or definitely things going on, but I'm just asking myself sometimes, is that enough? Are we fast enough? How much more resources, brains, time, do we have enough time for that? Which, leads me again to the other part, because I don't want to hold you up too much. To the other part of our discussion, which I wanted to initiate, is I know there's a topic. I don't know whether you've had time to research it a little bit, but as you know, the magnetic field of the Earth has been diminishing since the 1850s, and provably in the last decades, like every year by 5%. And there are so many studies coming out, of course, either not not really mainstream or suppressed or whatever, astrophysicists, geophysicists, and all of that. So I think a realistic scenario which could happen within the next 20-30 years, and that's the best case scenario, by the way, because I think these Earth disaster cycles, there's different layers, different phases of Earth disaster cycles. The smallest one is between 150 and 200 years, Carrington event. So is that something that occupies your mind a little bit? Because what we're talking about is once the communication information systems are destroyed or, somehow damaged, satellites, grid off, satellites destroyed. I mean, Bitcoin, I think, is the least worry that we're going to have. I think we'll need to start from scratch and build up a civilization, and then hopefully, plan or pre-plan a reset of of the Bitcoin blockchain and the whole infrastructure. Do you know where I'm going with this, or is that for you a reasonable, realistic scenario and concern that you have, or is that, do you think some most Bitcoiners or 99% of the Bitcoiners really deny or just ignore it, the reality?
Yeah, I mean, so the Carrington event was a big deal. It was, it happened, I think, in the mid-1800s. Essentially, it was a solar, if my memory serves me correctly, it was a solar storm that released enough electromagnetic radiation that it just fried the electrical systems on Earth, right? And essentially, yeah, like, I mean, if there, that's completely out of our control, if there's another solar storm and it does the same thing, and it will fry a lot of the electrical components once again. But I think that humanity, I think that people underestimate the ability for humanity to innovate. There's been so many natural disasters, throughout history that have just been horrific. And I think that we've learned from every single one of them. And I think that there's, just because something gets fried, just because some electrical components gets fried, I'm sure that there is one crazy Bitcoin psychopath that is running a Bitcoin node deep down in an underground bunker that is, going to be immune from, solar winds and solar storms, so to speak. So as long as there's, a couple Bitcoin nodes left, I think we'll be fine. I think it, for the mining, for all the miners, throughout the world, that's going to create a tough situation. But I also think that, like, regardless of Bitcoin, most of our society is just, it's run on, electronics and electricity, and it's run on via the internet. And, I work on my laptop almost on a daily basis. I work at a remote, both Simply Bitcoin and Swan are remote companies. So, and that's just me. Imagine the entire world, so many things are going to go down in that sense. So I think in that situation, like, the best course of action is, I hope you have a lot of food and I hope you have a lot of guns, because yeah, I think it'll boil down to,
yeah, we're going to go to existential modus, I mean, yeah. And the thing is, most people, I mean, I don't know, you believe or think that these Earth disaster cycles, they're like, it's like a far, I mean, if it was like a far off thing, like, what, 1,000 millions of years away, okay, who cares, but they're like, people, exponentially more intelligent, more knowledgeable than me, who've been researching this and, for decades, and it's overdue. these earth disasters are overdue. And I just mentioned Kerrigan, and I'm talking about like a bigger coronal mass ejections, solar shots, micronova. You know, this could start like beginning, you know, realistically in the 2040s and 50s. And I mean, I tried to ask a couple of people, even Adam Beck, but because I know he's one of the calmest, most rational, logical thinking, you know, like, you know, Blockstream satellite. I mean, yeah, but I just wanted to know, are there any alternative, you know, is there anything we can prepare for, alternative methods to make transactions still? Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, there's definitely a bunch of, like, you can send a Bitcoin transaction is just text. Like, you can send that using ham radio. You know, you can send that using, I forget what the exact name of the networks are. Like
radio mesh network.
Yeah, mesh, radio? Exactly. Mesh networks. You know, there's alternative ways to send Bitcoin transactions that's not hardwired into the internet. But most people use the internet to use Bitcoin transactions because that's the most convenient way. So yeah, I mean, it could totally fuck shit up, like 100%. Like if a Carrington event happens today, I think it will be 100 times worse, because back in, you know, the mid 1800s, like there was a lot of analog people, you know, woke yeah. up, you know, they still that... made, some of them still used gas
yeah.
to light their homes,
right?
Some, you know, they, some of so news papers. The world was very analog back then.
We're so dependent, man, Nico.
Yeah.
We're so dependent, you know, everything is electronic. And then on top of that, the magnetic field of the earth, I mean, is literally, I mean, it's like exponentially like decreasing, you know, every year and accelerating. It's like a curvature. It goes along like this, you know, I mean, this is what really worries me. And these are scientific provable facts. And we just need, you know, one bad solar storm, solar flares, or micronova, whatever, and we are pretty much, I mean, humanity will exist and other species too. But to you know, I don't know how much percentage will survive. I mean, when we're talking like the higher orders of the Earth disaster cycles. But you know, I'm really not a doom and gloom. I'm just trying to, you know, face reality. Like, okay, how do we prepare? What do we need to individually, as a family, or as a society, as a village? You know, like get together and help one another. And this is why I'm saying, oh God, you know, Bitcoin will become maybe so trivially forgotten because we don't need it anymore. We can't transact anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's definitely a problem, a possibility, for sure. It's you know, it's, but I think that history has shown that human beings have a tendency to survive and innovate and dig themselves out of, you know, horrific situations. So I think if a Carrington event 2.0 happens again, I think it will have dire consequences. But I also don't underestimate the ability of human beings to survive and then thrive.
Definitely, human ingenuity. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I don't have no doubts about the human ingenuity and the genius minds out there and the suppressed technologies. I mean, this is my hope that hopefully at that time before, you know, sometime before, you know, all these technologies will be unleashed, which have been compartmentalized, you know, within the military industrial complex, and which could, you know, eventually help us, protect us from all these, you know, natural earth disaster cycles. Yeah.
100%. 100%. Yeah, man. It's like you saying, like, that's the catch 22, so to speak. Right. It's
right.
Like the, you know, like I'm extremely optimistic about the future of the human race. I think that, you know, you have, and I know a lot of people dislike him, but like, you know, what Elon is doing with his, you know, his crusade to go to, you know, his crusade to land, like move, take some humans to Mars and whatnot, and thinking from like a perspective of being an interplanetary species. Like, I don't think he's going to see that in his lifetime. I don't think I'm going to see that in my lifetime, to be honest with you, but that type of thinking is real, because look, on a long-term basis, you know, the earth will be inhabitable. Like, you will not be able to live here just because of the expansion of the sun,
right?
And it will, that eventually will kill all life on Earth. And, you know, the sun is halfway through its life cycle. Eventually, it will die out, essentially. It will grow very, very big before it does that. And then it'll get very, very small. And then it'll become, you know, a brown dwarf. And, you know, essentially Earth will either melt away first and then freeze to death, but humans won't be able to live here and no life will be able to live here. So I think thinking about how to make Earth an interplanetary species, an interstellar species, is the only way to ensure humanity's survival in the long term. But I think that's all things that are going to happen outside of my lifetime. I'm just thinking about the here and now, and the battle of my life is just, you know, fighting for Bitcoin and the adoption of Bitcoin. Because I think that the adoption of Bitcoin is going to bring out the best of in humanity. It's going to bring the new renaissance in humanity. And I think that potentially it could lead to more geniuses like Elon that are going to be thinking about, you know, more other crazy inventions to further, you know, propel the human race, for the human race to prosper. And through prosperity comes more innovations, more technology. That allows us to, you know, tackle certain problems.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I mean, when it comes to the civilizational evolution and the human evolution and the technological evolution on every level imaginable, you know, that's what I always said. You know, this is what really excites me about Bitcoin, because it will give us so much comfort, joy, and you know, more leisure time, and you know, people can finally go after the things that they really want to do passionately, you know, and finally we can, you know, we don't need to work, you know, to exist, to survive. We're going to thrive, as you said, you know. So, and I know, you know, the technology is out there. It just needs to be unleashed and or decompartmentalized. And this is what sometimes, you know, makes me sad, that, you know, it's not only, you know, material or money or whatever, or existential things that have been stolen from us, at least in the last 100 years since the creation of central banks, but actually technological evolution, you know, innovation that's been stolen from us systematically, which is actually here, but we don't have access to it. And this is what really makes me sad. But, you know, on the other hand, yeah, I'm totally, you know, optimistic and bullish. So going back to that first question, I mean, even if, I just wanted to say, I mean, even if it, I could even imagine, you know, Bitcoin going, because I don't care about the price, but it's about the purchasing power. Even if it goes like abruptly, you know, like suddenly to millions of dollars. I mean, the thing is, by that time, even if it happens within the next 1 or 2 years, what kind of purchasing power are we talking about? Because do you see hyperinflation at that time? Because officially hyperinflation is 50% upwards, but we have already in certain, you know, services and products or, you know, things, in a way, you know, hyperinflation or monetary, you know, debasement.
Yeah, I mean, totally. Like, it could totally lead to, you know, you just never know. Like, that's the reality. Like, you never know what the, you never know, you know, the definition of hyperinflation, like how hyperinflation happens is not because the government is printing, you know, a crazy amount of money. Hyperinflation happens because there's a mass, on a societal level, the population just loses confidence in the currency, and all at the same time, they start to sell it for everything else. And then it just completely devalues. So I think that the US dollar is the strongest currency of all fiat currencies by far. I think it will be one of the last to hyperinflate, to be honest with you. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Maybe I'm completely wrong. All I know is that I put my energy, my time, my work, my money, my wealth, my future into Bitcoin. So, like, I know that whatever is happening in fiat world, I know that I'm okay and that my family's okay and that my future is okay, right? So yeah, like what these are some crazy times. You know, a lot of people buy into the theory of the fourth turning, I myself included. And all I know is that I think Bitcoin is one of the best ways to protect yourself and your future self and your family's future as well.
Awesome. Do you have kids, Nico?
I don't have kids, but I'm expecting a kid. So,
Hopefully, yeah, we need more Bitcoin kids. Yeah.
yeah,
We
so
have a daughter, yeah.
I should be a father in February. And that should be interesting. So I'm really
Congratulations,
looking
man.
forward to that. Thank you. I
Awesome.
appreciate that.
So happy for you. Well, anyway, Nico, yeah, was amazing talk to you again and get your insights and yeah, can you do you have any final words or and where can people find you? Is there anything upcoming? I mean, anything publication wise or anything you want to tell my audience?
So I mean, just keep tuning into Simply Bitcoin. Swan's dropping some awesome content too, and you can find me around. And thank you so much for the invite and for having me on. I had a great time.
All right. Nico, was great talking to you. See you next time.
Thanks, man.
Hopefully in person. Bye.